Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast, where we take you inside the world of mountain biking. First up, Happy New Year. Welcome to 2018, our first episode of the year, and excited to be back. We got plenty of stuff to come this year, loads of great guests coming up. The next thing we've got coming out is an Ask the Coach episode. So just before Christmas, we asked for all your questions about training and getting fit and ready for racing and riding in 2018. And we're going to be sitting down with Ben Plenger from Mountain Bike Strength Factory, answering as many of those questions as we can. And we hope to have that episode out on Thursday, the 4th of January for you. So just a couple of days away. Keep an eye out for that. To keep up to date, don't forget to follow us on social media. So we're at Downtime Podcast on Instagram, at The Downtime Podcast on Facebook, and at Downtime Tweets on Twitter. Also, if you're enjoying what we're doing and you've got some time, head over to iTunes and leave us a review there. It's really nice to know what you think of the podcast, and it's really helpful for other people trying to find decent mountain bike podcasts to listen to if they can see your reviews. So we'd really appreciate it if you got time to do that. Okay, so we're on episode 24. Can't quite believe it, but we are. And our guest this week is adventurer Jamie Nicol. Jamie's got a pretty fascinating story. He's overcome a lot of adversity to be where he is today. We sat down just before Christmas, had a good chat, and hopefully you'll enjoy listening to it. So, without further ado, here's episode 24 of the Downtime Podcast with Jamie Nicol. So, Jamie Nicol, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. Thanks for taking time out of your day to come and have a chat.
Yeah, thanks. It's good to be here.
So, yeah. You're out in California at the moment, right? What have you been up to in California?
Yeah, so it's sort of the end of the, I guess, yeah, the end of the year, and there's a whole lot of people getting together for end of year sort of summit meetings, talking about the coming 2018. And my girlfriend's there. She works for Santa Cruz now, so it's a good time for me to catch up with her. Because, so I'm basically here and getting out on the trails and catching up with people in between times. And then there's this sort of maybe infamous, I think is the right word, Christmas party on Saturday night. I think there's 500 have said they're coming to that. So, yeah.
Wow, that's a big party. That's going to be an interesting hangover on Sunday, isn't it?
Yeah, sounds like it. But brass bands and stilt walkers and all sorts of things have been promised. So it sounds like they put on quite a occasion for the party. I think they put a bit of effort into it. So yeah, heard a lot about them in the past. So it's good to be here for my first one.
Awesome. And did you get the chance to go to the showing of Wheel Love this week? I think they had a Santa Cruz based showing of the new 50-1 movie.
Yeah, that went off amazingly well. I think it was someone, Joe's idea at Santa Cruz. It's have it up in the forest. The famous tanks, these tanks that get painted by random artists from the area, seem to sort of no real rhyme or reason when they change, but they get changed. And so yeah, we had a projector and screen up there, and 50-1. Your UK boys were there as well, and they showed first Gary Perkins' slideshow, the one that was in the UK the other week, some of the trips too that I've been doing with him this year. So that was good to see them in big scale, and then onto the 50-1. And those boys put a lot of passion, a lot of love and that into their riding. It's great to see. It's gives you a different vibe next time you're out riding yourself. You're like, I've got to tap every tree with my back wheel and do all of this.
Yeah, definitely. It's amazing the stuff they've been doing. It's really good to watch. So let's wind the clock back a little bit for yourself. Can you tell us a bit about how you got into riding initially and you know, your journey into mountain biking?
Yeah, journey into mountain biking. I guess, I don't know, as a young kid looking for the right sport for me, and soccer. My dad was a passionate soccer player his whole life, and that wasn't really for me. I always wanted to be subbed and go play in the creek and climb trees, and so eventually ended up with mountain biking. And this is in sort of 1990, because my 12th birthday, got my first mountain bike, and get it as big as you can so you can grow into it. So there's some sort of 19-inch frame or something, and not what we'd go for now. And and I set out into that world, and that was kind of quite new in New Zealand back then. There was definitely happening, but I guess I just joined the local club and started going out for rides, and it all just grew from there into doing national races. And I sort of hooked up with these older boys. What was I then? I guess going into 13, 14 and starting to do races, and got in line with these older guys that were 20, 22, had their own car, and parents would drop me at the corner and I'd get picked up with these guys, and we'd go off camping and doing races around New Zealand. And as I said, grew into more and more, and doing the national series, touring the South Island during the summer. And of course, that sort of starts pointing you in the direction of going to world champs and things. And I think I had a couple of years of being second in the junior with Kashi Lukes, and heading to, I think it was Germany, was the first world champs, and near Freiburg at Black Forest in 96. And that was good times being over there. But I'm definitely always been an adventurer at heart. And so I spent a month or more after that backpacking round at 16 years old, and on my own, and hitchhiking and sleeping under bridges, and up through Scotland and into the highlands and hiking around. So that was me, and came back home, and it was another national series. And I think then for me it was just, I could see this future unfolding of mountain biking in that professional world. I guess I would have been heading into the expert open men's, and people were interested in sponsoring me properly and things like that. And I guess nationally people were trying to help you into just the sport into a more professional scene. And so some of these older men would comment about maybe that I should dress a bit more smartly at the podiums or that after these, little national cross-country junior races. And as a teenager and, quite self-driven person, that kind of just creates almost a rebellion in me at that age. Just ended up dressing more weirdly for the podiums and things. And, I wasn't into that sort of schooling into this professional world of tracksuits and baseball caps and things like that. That just wasn't where I came from. I liked my woolen jerseys and things like that. So, I think that put me off a bit. And we went from doing big loops of 30 or 40K loops to doing, five or six laps of some really small trail. And so I lost a little bit of spirit there in that last season in New Zealand. And so I just wanted to get out of it, and didn't want to kind of feel like I could see my whole future of just traveling the world and racing. And so I wanted to climb mountains and rock climb and explore the world and things. And so that's sort of what I went and did. Spent a couple of years traveling and backpacking, and did outdoor guide training, and spent a lot of time in the New Zealand Alps and doing a lot of hard climbing and difficult mountaineering routes and things. So it was good times.
Awesome. And did you miss the riding at that point, or you kind of had enough of it?
No, I think I needed that. And I've always felt I'm quite a multi-disciplined person. And so, I was started doing a bit of local racing after I came back from overseas and just had my hardtail. And just did a bit of that and and the weekends and things, all that sort of classic, just mucking around riding. And then it wasn't till I finished 2 years in a quite a remote part of the South Island, working for the Department of Conservation, which is sort of the Parks Board, and spending, you know, big weeks in the backcountry, being helicoptered in and out. Wasn't till that sort of finished up that I sort of got involved with these trail building bit jobs with this billionaire guy through Dodsey and his partner Gabby, who I went to school with. So that was a connection into that. And so, yeah, found myself in Mexico and another very remote spot for a 3-month contract, leading the team there and building trails. And my bike looked pretty archaic then. It was a bit of a joke, but, you know, it was my bike and I'd been proud of it for years and had, you know, been sort of not in the scene enough to see how bikes had changed so much. So, you know, they had these bikes sitting around there. There were giant reins. This is 2009, and I got on some of these and I was like, well, this is amazing, you know, what you can do on these bikes. And they look quite good. I always had this memory of down full suspended bikes having big holes through their frame and just not looking particularly nicely laid out frames, as my impression of bikes at that point. And so, yeah, seeing a kind of a clean giant, this giant thing sitting there, and just how capable they were on these you know, Mexican sort of desert trails, it's just really rocky terrain. I really got quite taken by that, and so yeah, bought my first Santa Cruz someone brought it over the Mexican border, and yeah, soon I was off into the full suspended bike world and starting to push that scene.
Awesome. And it was while you were out working on the trail building side of things that your accident happened, right? Are you able to tell us a little bit about what happened then?
So it was after I was back in New Zealand, came back and went to Patagonia, Chile, and did a 3-month contract there, and had 3 months up in Canada and Whistler and riding there. And to return to New Zealand, I planned to do another contract in Patagonia, Chile. So, again, a very remote spot too. You fly into a small regional airport of Coyhaique and then head on rough dirt roads out an hour from there to catch a jet boat across a lake to a lodge. Beautiful, beautiful scenery, long lakes with steep rocky faces and beech forest. So and a lot of burnt out trees from when they cleared the land to create grazing and things. So that was the scene, and I was obviously returning there and was not what were we? We're, I think, 2 weeks into the contract. I was there with Wynn Masters. He was I was passing on the kind of training leadership part of what I'd learned from my different crew leader roles. So setting him up because he was crew leading and I was working on more sort of specialized rope work. We were trying to cut through some rock ledges and create rideable benches. So it was where the main crew were, was sort of 20 minutes walk from where we were working, and they were working towards us, and we had our ropes set up above us. I think the best word, sort of like a ravine, it's kind of a gorge, but going down a sequence of waterfall type cascades down a very steep mountainside, but quite a deep gut in the rock. And there was this one area which was sort of the only way you could get through on foot, but it was sort of a little bit sketchy, just on foot, not carrying a bike. So we're trying to open that up, and we'd been working a few days on that, and we had these two-stroke powered rock breakers, which were kind of brand new, but obviously there was something wasn't quite right about it, and there's still sort of unknown what really went wrong. But I was using this machine and noticed some drips of fuel on my trousers, and just sort of tweaked the fuel cap up to see if that would stop the dripping, but it didn't. So I turned the machine off, took it back over to take the fuel tank lid off, to thought maybe there's a little bit of, you know, a little stone or something on the seal or something causing it not to seal. So just casually took the lid off, but it sort of the best way to describe it was some sort of like someone had shaken up a soda bottle, and when I took the lid off, there was just this huge, well, it was an explosion, but without fire. So it was just a massive plume of atomized fuel came out of the tank. Obviously, a huge surprise. Sort of 7 to 10 meters up into the air. The guys on the other side of the ravine through the bush saw this cloud of fuel go up into the air, sprayed all my chest and face, and I was just feeling wet and, you know, spitting when it just about to spit out this fuel that was in my mouth. And say to the friend Ash that I was working with, you know, get me some water because I wanted to wash out my eyes. It was sort of stinging in my eyes and in my mouth, the fuel. And then it was just like, it was bang. And so, yeah, that fuel, from what we can work out, the fuel tank had become really heated somehow, creating this huge amount of pressure in the tank. And so, you know, that's why it was leaking, because it was just had so much pressure in it that it, it exploded like that. And then there was no ignition source there, but yeah, that 3 seconds, 4 seconds after I took that lid off and had been sprayed with the fuel, it all just ignited. And I don't know, I assume that the heat of the fluid or the atomizing of the fuel, that it just made it so volatile that some people have suggested that can ignite just with the meeting of the oxygen. So anyway, I suddenly was in this big ball of flames, and so I jumped off the ledge because I was on ropes and harnesses to get away from this machine that had just exploded into fire. And as I swung through the air on those ropes, I realized I was that ball of fire, and the fire was coming with me. And I tried to rip up my T-shirt and sort of then remembered that I had this full body harness on, and so I couldn't get my T-shirt off, which obviously had all the fuel on it. And so, yeah, I was smacked into the ledge where I, you know, had fell down and the ropes caught me, and then I was just had my head up in the air and I was just beating my face. And I guess a couple of seconds, just winding back a couple of seconds as I swung through the air, I just had this, you know, I was like, this is interesting. Quite a calm thought. This is interesting. This might be something that I might die here, because there was no obvious way out of the situation. And so it was quite an unknown what was going to happen next. And there I was, beating my face and had my head up in the air. And I did have there was some panic there, and I was calling to my mate, calling for help, because as I said, I didn't see a way out of it. And I was tied on, couldn't get on the ground, I couldn't get my clothes off, couldn't roll on the ground, all these things you hear about that you're meant to do. And was there beating my face and yelling to my mate. And then I realized, well, you really can't burn for very long, otherwise you're going to be screwed. And so then I pulled my head down into the flames to start working on undoing my helmet and my harness. And it was in this time that the flames just finished burning, and yeah, it all went out. And so I guess we're talking, I don't know, it's a guess, but 30 to 40 seconds might have been swinging there, burning. And that's a long time when you think about holding your hand over a candle or something like that. And so, you know, I looked down and saw my arms that were a sort of grey peeled sort of skin. And yeah, just my hands as well didn't look good. Quickly undone carabiners and swung across to a ledge and undid the carabiners and just bolted down the bank and into this freezing water. There's water there that was pouring out of an avalanche snowpack, and I don't know, I think I was pretty much hypothermic then. So we got out of there pretty quick. Had to run sort of 3K through the mountains, a couple of hundred vert down to a lake, met a jet boat, and that took me across to the lodge. And yeah, I mean, it's a tricky story to tell it quick, but yeah, I was dancing around the lodge there for a bit, and someone had gone for help when straight after the accident. They got to Windmaster's crew, and Wynn did a very fast run down the mountainside to the main lodge. Still thinks it's one of his quickest runs he's done, and came in there. You know, New Zealand style is like we need a helicopter. New Zealand, we use helicopters a lot, and so he just went in there yelling, "We need a helicopter." You know, he had been on the radio as well, but no one really talked English, and these sort of problems of yeah, being in the remote Spanish-speaking parts of Patagonia. And so I was lucky enough to be at the lodge maybe 20 minutes, and through a very, very lucky bunch of connections, someone had known someone who knew the military helicopter pilot in the local town, and so they got direct clearance to bring in a military helicopter, and they picked me up from this lake. And yeah, still really strong memories, and took me through to the local hospital, and I don't remember anything from there. It was a couple of weeks in an induced coma. I was air ambulance to Santiago Hospital the next day, but obviously I don't remember any of that. And yeah, it was a long process of recovery. Started from there, very complicated injury, the burns, so affects huge part of so many parts of your body, so you can die from so many different problems or failures of organs, or yeah, the skin and the body is not happy to be burnt that badly. So 35% at third degree burns, or full thickness, and that can set you back pretty bad for quite a long time.
Yeah, so a big recovery process, and a lot of mental strength as well, I guess, to get through something like that. I read somewhere, I don't know if this is true, but you through sometime through that period you dreamt about going racing again. Is that right?
Yeah, through this I was in this induced coma, and I did have a few interesting memories from being in that coma, and waking up I was slightly confused about whether I had done some race, because I had this very vivid memory of having won a race wearing a kind of blue kit and kind of standing on top of a mountain. It wasn't like I was at a podium, but I just won this race, and I was really happy about that, and I was up on top of this very barren mountain, and And so, yeah, I was a bit confused if had that happened and I just sort of couldn't remember where it was, or was it just a kind of a dream? And so, yeah, even when I was still in the intensive care unit, I remember saying to my girlfriend and my mother that, you know, I think I want to go back to racing. And at that point, I did the Crankworx Enduro, which was a few weeks before, which was the 2010, and that was a single stage down from above the top of Garbo, and did that with, I remember, I think Remy Absalon won it, and I was the second behind Justin Leov, and I'm a giant with the borrowed full face helmet and super tacky DH Minion on the back, which I still can remember as being like one of those nightmare dreams you have as a kid where you're trying to run away and you're in like some sort of deep sand feeling and you can't run as fast as you want. I always remember that. But yeah, so there I was, and I was like, no, that's not where I'd done this race. And so yeah, it was.
So did that thought of getting back to racing help drive you on and keep you going through all the recovery from the accident?
It did. I mean, yeah, I was in that hospital thinking, you know, I'll be back pretty soon, but and I was for the accident, for how badly injured I was back. I nearly halved the time I was in the hospital, so I was a bit over 2 months, and they had thought I'd be there for more like 4 months, and that's before I'm even taken back to New Zealand. And so they had a lot of operations, a lot of skin grafting, a lot of very intensive fevers and infection and things. Yeah, I mean, you're just this huge open wound. And so, yeah, back to New Zealand, and would cycle down to the hospital and do my rehab there and scar management and all of this sort of thing. And, you know, you got to imagine, I couldn't even stand up on my pedals because the supporting muscles and things that stabilize your knees, it was just too painful on my knees because, you know, I've got pretty big calves. And always had quite big calf muscles, and they were like, when I was in hospital, they were like boiled eggs that, you know, hung around the back of my legs. So there's a lot of, you know, your body just robs that protein to try and build that skin, as well as the natural atrophy of, you know, sitting in that bed for so long and not being able to get out. So yeah, that was, would ride to the hospital and slowly get stronger, and I had to come up quite a steep hill back to where we were staying. This is in Lower Hutt in Wellington, New Zealand. And so, that was, I guess, the initial rehab. And then as I got a little bit stronger, I started meeting up with some mates and doing some really, I guess not small rides, but just getting out and riding. It was difficult. You had to, you know, your fingers, the burns on your fingers, the skin would fall apart every time you sort of did anything for too long with too much sort of, you know, abrasion or vibration. You know, it was months before I could hold a knife and cut a slice of cheese or open door handles or wring out a towel or, you know, so it's a lot of things you're dealing with, as well as this huge lack of energy or and continual stretching to try and stretch this shrinking scar tissue. So very much a feeling of fighting yourself there as well. So a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, and so you managed to get from that position to, I think, was it 10th overall in the 2013 Enduro World Series as a privateer?
Was it 13? Yeah, was, that's right. So there was quite a accelerated time from these burns as that energy increased. Basically, I just my body had been working so hard, I just kind of increased that into the riding world, and I had so much energy in a sense, even though I was dealing with still for a long time this kind of lag of tiredness from my body putting effort into building skin. My recovery rate from going training and riding was, you know, it was phenomenal when I look at back at that period. I pushed myself so hard, and yeah, that has results. I mean, I headed over to do some of these races because the sort of we're doing Super D's or these small single stage enduros in New Zealand, and I really thought this is for me. And did well in them. I'd been doing a bit of downhill racing, and talked to Sven Martin because I remember seeing some of his photos of muddy guys on trail bikes and in the Alps. And he lives locally, and he's like, "Yeah, you should come over," because I was asking about Mega Avalanche, and he's like, "Yeah, do this," and but you should come here and do this race before this race. And so he sort of created this whole schedule, and I headed over and did a first year before the World Series. Then really loved it and had done quite well against some of the really good riders, and then headed back for the first year of the EWS as a privateer. Huge amount of training, pushed myself incredibly hard back in New Zealand, working on one of these properties in the Nelson, New Zealand area for this same guy during the summer, saving up my cash and heading over to Europe and the Northern Hemisphere to hit up the World Series. And that's right. So at the end of that, I ended up eighth in the world, which with a podium third place at Whistler, which is a really nice kind of circle to come back round there and do so well in Whistler, and some other sort of fifths and things at some other rounds. So I'd missed the first opening round in Punta Ala too, so I was down one race. So I was proud to, with my points, proud to end up eighth in the world. I was really happy, and that had totally come from myself, and you know, it wasn't driven by any sponsor pressure or anything. I was just there to do the best I could, and I think it's the, you know, it's the best way that someone can push themselves their hardest is to be there really because they want to be and for no other reason.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal achievement, and there's a lot of people, certainly at the minute, I think I've seen on social media all the EWS entries have been announced, and there's a lot of people that have got wildcard entries and are going to be having a go for the first time and doing it as a privateer. What advice would you give to riders that are going to take on a challenge like that?
Yeah, I guess it's that sort of thing. Don't focus on trying to become a professional. I think go out there, smile and be a nice guy and get to know people and do your best. And you know, I think that's where it comes from. And you know, it was to become professional was a byproduct for me of, you know, of that personal focus. And so I guess really get your goals in your mind, why you're there and what it is you're pushing for, and go for it and have a good time. So I think it sort of works something like that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I guess once you make that effort to get to know people as well, are people pretty helpful in that scene for privateers that are working their way up?
They are. I mean, they are. The enduro scene, from what I understand from maybe any of the scenes, is one of the most family-like, for a better word. I think it's that you're out there on these journeys of doing your racing, and you know, people have problems and other people stop and help them, and you're riding as a group between race stages. And I think that's where you create a lot of this camaraderie and bonding with the other people. And so there is always a essence of helping. You know, people would put me up in their hotel rooms or give me lifts to places, and there is, and people throw you a spare tire that's been used a few times, and you know, there's definitely people out there that help. And I think, you know, it's not just about your results, but you can go, as if you look out and into that social media world, there's a lot of people that do very well because they're good people and good characters, and people get sponsored because they're, you know, they're good people or good times people, or have a great attitude or are great characters. And so yeah, just you remember that you're sort of kind of not owed anything, and yeah, that makes sense.
Cool. Yeah, good stuff. Good stuff. We've got a couple of questions that we have asked most of our guests now, so we'll go over to those and get your take on them. So the first one is, if our listeners had roughly £100 to improve their performance on a bike, whether that, you know, to get faster, stronger, whatever it happens to be, what would you recommend they spend that money on? And it can be bike bits, it can be training, it could be anything.
Yeah, interesting. I don't know, I say to a lot of people that it's that brakes are really for the enduro over any, especially if you're getting into the blind racing stuff, that I think, you know, especially some women that I've are friends with, I've, you know, told them to get better, the best brakes you can buy. And so whether you get your sort of downhill Shimano brakes or whatever, something that you can stay more relaxed for longer on the handlebars and stay riding aggressively because you're putting less effort into braking and hanging on. I think that helps a lot of people because I've seen it with myself. And so I think that's I don't know if that £100 is going to get you there, but it must be close.
It might, yeah, get you one of them anyway.
Yeah.
And the other question was, if you could wind back the clock and sit and have a chat with your 16-year-old self, what advice would you give them?
Yeah. Probably like I was alluding to there, is just relax and, you know, try and enjoy the ride in the bigger sense too, because I think it is easy, and even for myself, probably anyone who is potentially a high-performing athlete, you know, you are a perfectionist and you do expect a lot from yourself, and you can get frustrated and you know, yeah. And so I guess that it's just try and enjoy it and don't expect things always from yourself, or, you know, things will go wrong. And so I guess relax and then enjoy the ride.
Cool. That's good advice. I like that. And we've got another question that we've kind of added recently, I guess, that came out of a conversation with Jack Redden. But the question is, if you could pick any rider in the world to have a coaching session from, who would it be and why?
Well, I kind of immediately jumped to a bigger sense of a coaching session. And like I say, it's sort of, I think also as an athlete, an all-round attitude. And so, yes, you want to be that high-performance, highly focused athlete. But, you know, I see a lot of athletes that they are some of the world's best, but they're so mutantly focused on being the best that they stay in their hotel rooms because their feet have to be up in the air for 2 hours, or, you know, and you never see them out having a drink or chilling at the local cafe or the coffee shop or down at the pits talking to people. And so, you know, for me that award or coaching would be, you know, I learned a lot from Jerome Clements. He is obviously a very world-class rider, but he's able to make that mix of, you know, he's still out there and can socialize and sit and have a drink. And he can see that so much of that maybe is in your mind that, yeah, of course it might be as good to have your feet up, but it's actually also really good to sit there and chill with some friends and talk about some stuff that's going down. And so, yeah, coaching, and obviously he can ride a bike well. So I think you could learn a lot from going out for a general all-round coaching session with Jerome.
Awesome. I've never really thought about it, but every photo I've ever seen of him, I think he's got a massive smile on his face. So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Awesome. And while you're on, just to pick your brains, we've got a lot of listeners that, you know, they love the ride and they like to travel. You've had the opportunity to travel and ride in a lot of different places around the world. Maybe give us two or three from the top of your list, what areas would you recommend people head out and try?
Yeah, I mean, these last years I've been traveling and still working as a professional athlete and organizing silver adventure trips for for journalists and new bikes that we've got coming out from Santa Cruz. But so I've seen in a lot of new places, and I've enjoyed that new style of maybe riding and seeing the world. And yeah, new places. I had a great trip up in Arctic Finland this year. And you know, that was amazing because it was a multi-day trip with slightly more XC, but a lot of huts, and then through to being in the Swiss Alps and riding that really steep, rocky terrain. So I don't know, it's a tricky one. I think the French Alps through your Trans-Provence type style terrain, and that northern area into Switzerland, it gives so much because there's just so many tracks, and I love how they're there because of an ancient sort of tradition of people heading into the Alps and not being specifically built for mountain bikes. So they've had centuries of weathering, and so I think you get such a lot of reward and surprises from riding in the Alps. So I'd have to say that at the moment, I really enjoy the exploring from the Alps. So.
Awesome. Very good. Very good. Well, it's been great chatting. I'd love to have you on again and chat some more at some point, and find out more about what you've been up to. But in the meantime, if people want to keep in touch and follow your adventures, whereabouts can they find you on social media?
Yeah, so on Instagram, it's Jamie Nicol Adventures. Same with Facebook, or just Jamie Nicol on Facebook. And yeah, should see me coming through on some of my co-sponsors' social media pages too. But yeah, that's where you can find me. And yeah, flick me a message and feel free to get in touch that way as well.
Awesome. Nice one. Thank you. Well, thanks a lot for your time today. We hope you have a good Christmas party on Saturday.
Yeah.
And yeah, we look forward to seeing your adventures over the next couple of years.
Yeah.
Nice one.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed a bit of my background.
Good stuff. Cheers, Jamie.
Cheers, man.
Well, that's it for episode 24. I really hope you enjoyed listening. I know I enjoyed chatting to Jamie, such an inspirational guy, really interesting story, and had a great time. So if you did, head over to iTunes, leave us a review there. It really helps things. Really appreciate that. Keep in touch over on social media. Keep sending your messages. Always really nice to hear from you. We've got more great stuff coming up. We've got the Ask the Coach episode, hopefully on Thursday this week. That's the 4th of January. And then we'll have another great guest for you on the 16th. So keep in touch, stay tuned, and until then, get out and ride.